Hello, I'm novelist and critic Tim Lucas, inviting you to imagine with me that it's the evening of Sunday, March 4, 1973, and we're about to watch Night Gallery's third season episode, Death on a Barge. But it's going to look much better now than it looked then, almost 50 years ago. If you were part of this episode's initial viewing audience, you must have been one tenacious Night Gallery viewer. Canceled by NBC the previous January, Night Gallery had been off the air since its previous episode, Something in the Woodwork, which aired on January 14. At that point, the show was taken off the air, its Sunday 10 o'clock time slot given over to Jack Webb's new adventure series, Escape. As it happens, Escape proved even less of a draw for Sunday night audiences, and after only three episodes, NBC issued a sudden press release to the effect that Night Gallery would be given a surprise revival on this particular evening, and that remaining segments would resume on May 13. Against all odds, I happened to see this episode on its initial run. It's not so much the story that stands out in memory, but rather a detail in Rod Serling's introduction. When he says tonight's story will involve vampires, he mentions that the word conjures up thoughts of Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee. In early 1973, even though Lee's series of Dracula pictures for Hammer Films had just about run their course, Dracula was still the exclusive province of Bela Lugosi in the minds of most people, especially stand-up comics. I think it's worth noting that Serling's acknowledgement of Christopher Lee was the first time I remember him being mentioned as Lugosi's equal in the role anywhere outside the pages of Monster magazines. It meant a lot to me then, and it means a lot to me now. The directorial debut of actor Leonard Nimoy, Death on a Barge is an unusual vampire story for its time. Only in its climactic moments does it resort to traditional vampire imagery. Everything that comes before seems more evocative of the biblical versions of the femme fatale, such as Lilith, Delilah, Salome, or perhaps some of the mythological expressions of this archetype, such as the Lamia, the Gorgons, Sirens, and Nymphs, even the Mexican figure known as La Llorona, the Crying Woman. What I find most inviting and persuasive about Nimoy's direction is how these scenes on the wharf are played. They feel almost French in their misty romanticism, and as something of an atmospheric throwback to those poetic horror films of RKO producer Val Lewton from the 1940s. Films like Cat People, The Leopard Man, and The Ghost Ship.
I know.
I couldn't get up the nerve to speak, really. Aren't you lonely?
Yes, I'm lonely.
What do you say I come across and talk to you?
No, never.
I don't know your name.
It's Hyacinth.
For the central role of his seductive sea vampire, Hyacinth, Nimoy cast Leslie Ann Warren, a native New Yorker born in August 1946. The name Hyacinth itself is derived from Greek mythology, where we find Hyacinthus, the male lover of the sun god Apollo, and beloved of many for his singing and songwriting, which may liken this character most specifically to those tormentors of Ulysses, the Sirens. It's said that at the moment of his death, Hyacinthus bled, and that the flower we know today as the hyacinth rose from the soil that drank his blood. Leonard Nimoy and Leslie Ann Warren worked together for a season on Mission Impossible when Warren replaced actress Barbara Bain, much as Nimoy had been brought in to replace Bain's original co-star and husband, Martin Landau, on the show. Like Nimoy and his own love-hate relationship at this time to his Star Trek character Mr. Spock, Warren was struggling to distance herself from a hugely successful national debut in the 1965 TV production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. The color broadcast was so popular that it became a TV perennial for a few years, and Warren herself was put under immediate contract by Walt Disney, much as Julie Andrews, her predecessor in the Broadway play version, had been. She made a couple of films for Disney, but wanted badly to move into more adult roles and did not renew her contract. She received a Golden Globe nomination for her work on Mission Impossible, but she abandoned the character of Dana Lambert. And then from 1972 through 1975, she dropped the middle name from her professional billing, something few, if any, actresses have done successfully. She started seeking out sexier roles, and even though she won a Golden Globe Award for her work in the miniseries Harold Robbins' 79 Park Avenue, she rarely broke out of television into feature film work. Even though she made TV movies with tantalizing titles like Portrait of a Stripper and Portrait of a Showgirl, it's this episode of Night Gallery that shows her as sexy as any woman could be on network television back in 1973. Her earnest co-star, Robert Pratt, is sometimes cited as having been discovered by Peter Fonda, who cast him in his own directorial debut, The Hired Hand, in 1971. However, he was under contract to Universal a year earlier, and it was due to his Universal contract that he found work in Universal-produced programming, such as the TV movies Dial Hotline and The Neon Ceiling, and the series The Name of the Game, The Bold Ones, Marriage Year One, Marcus Welby, M.D., and Night Gallery. I can't say that Robert Pratt gives an uncommitted performance. I think his performance is quite sincere. However, I do feel that he's miscast. He's got the general cut of a supporting player rather than a leading man. He's the kind of actor who gets cast as the leading man's best friend a lot of the time. It's also a passive role to begin with, this romantic who finds the woman of his dreams only when he's asleep, very much like Fernand Gravy in Marcel Lherbier's 1942 French fantasy, La Nuit Fantastique. This part is stock footage, but I like the effect of it very much. Here we have Brooke Bundy as Phyllis, Ron's girlfriend, and pretty strong competition if you ask me, in a romantic contest with Leslie Ann Warren. A staple of popular television for 30-plus years, she had previously worked with Leonard Nimoy on a two-part episode of Mission Impossible, The Controllers. Hyacinth's father, a character who is mentioned in the original story, though he plays no active part in it, is played by Jim Bowles, who was born in Lubbock, Texas, and started acting on Los Angeles radio broadcasts back in 1938. He later followed better opportunities to New York City, where he performed in more than 1,000 radio programs and live television productions over the next quarter century. On the Broadway stage, he appeared opposite Ingrid Bergman in a theatrical revival of Eugene O'Neill's similarly wharf-bound Anna Christie. Nothing I could find on Jim Bowles mentioned a missing limb, so this peg leg stuff is all Hollywood hocus-pocus and pretty well done. When he died of a heart seizure in May 1977, Jim Bowles was only 63 years old. Death on a Barge was one of the earliest modern-day vampire stories to be shot for television in the wake of Dan Curtis's ratings bonanza of 1972, The Night Stalker. This scene of Phyllis brazenly tracking Hyacinth to her lair recalls Darren McGavin's cornering of vampire Janos Skorzeny in his decrepit suburban home in that memorable ABC movie of the week. Notice the dry ice mist hovering at floor level. It has no reason for being there, but Dan Curtis pulled the same trick in his 1970 modern-day vampire feature, House of Dark Shadows. I think it's fairly evident that Leonard Nimoy prepared himself for this assignment by looking at some of the more successful recent work in the genre. As that scene demonstrated, a half-hour segment doesn't really leave a director the necessary time to create suspense, even during important critical scenes, much less the time to develop and delineate character, relationships, the geography of a story. Scenes have to be condensed, like this one, which finds Phyllis conspiring with Ron's older brother Jake, played by Lou Antonio, and studying the essential rules of vampirism with Ron snoozing just a foot or so away from their table. Ron doesn't even have time to kick his shoes off, because then he'd have to put them back on again. And what is with this dialogue? Phyllis tries to keep hold of Ron by offering him a game of chess or billiards. And why is she so thick with Jake, who turns out to be such a jerk? suggesting that he and his brother share Hyacinth.
But once night falls, they turn into spirits of evil, roaming abroad, killing body and soul of their victims. There are only two ways to control the fiendish fangs. One, isolate the victim so she is surrounded by flowing water, the barge, right? For this, they can never cross. The only other control is death. And the only possible way to inflict death on a vampire is to expose her to sunlight or take a stake made of oak and run her through.
Death on a Barge is based on a classic, much anthologized novelette, The Canal by Everell Worrell, which first appeared in the December 1927 issue of Weird Tales magazine. It was adapted by Halstead Wells, a veteran television writer who had hammered out numerous episodes of Suspense, Suspicion, Kraft Suspense Theater, and Alfred Hitchcock Presents, as well as the classic Delmer Daves Western, 310 to Yuma, and several earlier Night Gallery episodes, including The Phantom Farmhouse, The Dark Boy, The Sins of the Father, and The Return of the Sorcerer. This episode has a lot going for it, fine performances, an intermittently brooding atmosphere during the night scenes, and I think it also shows that Nimoy had studied well the vampire films and tropes that were gaining popularity in the early 1970s. The real problem with this episode is that it shows a 44-page story, a novelette, as its source material. There was simply no way of adapting it to tick all of the original narrative's boxes without rushing through the story at a breakneck pace. It wouldn't surprise me to find out that Halstead Wells originally adapted this material as a longer script because, as is, this episode plays more like an extended trailer than a proper episode. That said, the scenes between Leslie Warren and Robert Pratt as they speak to one another through the sea mist at night are beautifully done.
Some dish you cut.
Oh, man. Thanks for spying. You're gonna fill us both.
No. I mean it. It would really be tasty and exotic. You know what I mean? What do you say we share it, huh?
As it is, it's difficult to get a handle on Lou Antonio's character of Jake, Ron's older brother. Here, he comes across as a real creep, yet Ron seems to trust him with his waking time girlfriend, Phyllis. Antonio had previously worked with Nimoy in the 1969 Star Trek episode Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, in which he played the role of Lokai, and he also worked with Nimoy and Warren in the 1970 Mission Impossible episode The Hostage. Antonio also had quite an extensive career as a television director, and Nimoy probably found it useful to have a more experienced hand on his team, should one be needed. The Band-Aid on Jake's face is a measly correspondent to that punch on the jaw he got, and it will disappear in his next and final scene as quickly as it came. At the end of this scene, which finds them arguing loudly in front of other people about Ron's attraction to a vampire, Jake exclaims, "Bambino," which suggests that theirs is an Italian, and therefore almost certainly Catholic family, none of which the episode has any time to address. Our protagonist Ron explains his attraction to Hyacinth as part of his appetite for risk, which couldn't be farther away from the protagonist of the original story. When he adds that he might also simply want to get close enough to her to learn the truth that vampires really exist, is somewhat closer to the mark. I find it fascinating to look back at the moment in time when this episode premiered and find absolutely no mention in any newspaper or magazine that Death on a Barge was going to be, among other things, the directorial debut of actor Leonard Nimoy. But we must remember that in 1973, Star Trek and Mr. Spock were not the classic, even mythic things they are today. Night Gallery was an NBC program, and insofar as they were concerned, Star Trek was just another canceled NBC series. True, it had been running in syndication since 1969, but it wasn't until 1986, after more than two decades in syndication, that it suddenly became the number one syndicated TV program on offer. Also, in the first quarter of 1973, you could say that the initial excitement about Leonard Nimoy had also waned. Then, 42, Nimoy, who had been rarely more than inconspicuous in the film and television roles he'd been playing since 1951, had enjoyed 3 years of sudden celebrity in the role of Mr. Spock on Star Trek, a celebrity that spread to headshot posters and talk show appearances, and also made it possible for him to release albums of his own singing. When the show was canceled, he hopped networks to CBS, where he took the role of Paris, a master of disguise, in the fourth and fifth seasons of Mission Impossible. He left the show in 1971, when he co-starred in a Western called Catlow, starring Yul Brynner and Dahlia LaVie. During this period, Nimoy began to vigorously resist identification with the role of Mr. Spock, which was beginning to reach more viewers in reruns than had ever seen it in first run. He was concerned that such typecasting might prove limiting to his ongoing career. In an effort to bring his versatility to the people, he made the decision to learn how to fly and bought his own private plane, then made himself available as a stage actor around the country. He accepted regional theater invitations to play Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof and Fagin in Oliver. During this time, he also accepted a lead role in a second season episode of Night Gallery, She'll Be Company for You. He used that opportunity to press the show's producer Jack Layard into letting him direct, as he had done for other Night Gallery actors like John Astin and Jeff Corey. Eventually, Layard offered him the script for this episode, which had the distinction of being based on a story by one of the few female contributors to Weird Tales magazine, Everell Worrell. Everell Worrell was born on November 3, 1893, in Loup City, Nebraska. Her birth name was Everell Worrell Murphy. According to her daughter, Jean Eileen Murphy, who wrote an essay about her mother for the first issue of Robert Weinberg's The Weird Tales Collector, she was born 1 minute after midnight, 1 day after All Souls Day, or the Day of the Dead. Her father worked in a great many places as a teacher and accountant, so as a child she moved around a great deal and lived in a great many cities and even exotic places, including Guam. She also had a great many interests, including writing, as well as painting, singing, and playing the violin. She attended two different colleges and worked for the U.S. government as a stenographer until she married in 1926. Once she felt herself stabilized in marriage, she began to write more seriously, and she submitted her first story, Leonora, to Weird Tales in late 1926. It was promptly accepted and appeared in their January 1927 issue, the same issue that debuted H.P. Lovecraft's novelette The Horror of Red Hook, and August Derleth's story, The Night Rider. Her second submission was the more ambitious story, The Canal, which was presented as a novelette in the December 1927 issue of Weird Tales, illustrated by Hugh Rankin, alongside the first magazine appearance of the short story, Dracula's Guest, by Bram Stoker. Weird Tales thought enough of Worrell's story to reprint it in their April 1935 issue with new illustrations by the celebrated Margaret Brundage. After that appearance, it subsequently appeared in about a dozen anthologies, sometimes in an expurgated version that runs about 2,000 words shorter. It would have been beyond the series' means to present Ms. Worrell's story as it's written. It begins by introducing its male protagonist, identified only as Morton, a name derived from the French word for death, a recent college graduate who sees himself as possibly mad, even as a likely eventual suicide, because he has a solitary nature and is drawn to the darkness in things. He accepts an invitation from a hopeful friend at the office to visit him at the Riverside camp where he's staying. It's implied that this friend may be homosexual and reading Morton's personality as that of a fellow outsider. The two men take a motorboat ride together, during which Morton realizes there's nothing for him in this place, nor in this friendship. Quote, "That far bank of the river was no place for an eccentric solitary man to love. But the near bank, which would have been an eyesore to the campers had not the river been so wide, the near bank attracted me from my first glimpse of it," end quote. Morton subsequently seeks out this maligned part of town and puts his own safety at risk by driving there and taking long walks at night. Quote, I left behind that part of town which was thick with vehicles, carrying people home from their evening engagements, and began to thread my way through darker and narrower streets. Once I had to back out of a cul-de-sac, and once I had to detour around a closed block. This part of town was not alluring, even to me. It was dismal without being solitary. But when I had parked my car on a rough cobbled street that ran down into the inky waters of the canal and crossed a narrow bridge, I was repaid. A few minutes set my feet on the old towpath where mules had drawn riverboats up and down only a year or so ago. Across the canal now, as I walked upstream at a swinging pace, the miserable shacks where miserable people lived seemed to march with me, and then fell behind. They looked like places in which murders might be committed, every one of them, end quote. Morton's first sighting of Hyacinth herself comes about as a result of his insistent peering into the darkness. Quote, I looked straight ahead at the softly swaying silhouette of the treetops across the canal as they moved gently in the cool night wind, at the massive blackness that was those trees and the opposite shore, at the shiny blackness where the reflections of the clouds glinted vaguely and disappeared. That was the canal. And now as I grew more accustomed to the greater blackness and my pupils expanded, I dimly discerned the contours of an old boat or barge half sunken in the water. But I was dreaming. Or was there a white-clad figure seated on the roof of the low cabin aft, a pale, heart-shaped face gleaming strangely at me from the darkness, the glow of two eyes seeming to light up the face and to detach it from the darkness? That daintily heart-shaped face was the face of a girl, surely. I was seeing it clearer and clearer, either because my eyes were growing more accustomed to peering into the deeper shadows, or because of that phosphorescence in the eyes that stared back at me, end quote. The story clearly takes place in what would have been the contemporary time in which it was written, 1927. Its detailing of the campsite conjures up a vivid impression of Depression-era America. But it wastes no time, as the Halsted Wells adaptation does, on Morton's family, nor is there any girlfriend who becomes jealous of the other woman he sees by night. As we can surmise from this filming, Hyacinth is cut off from dry land by the waters in which the barge is entrenched. It's not an aspect of vampire lore that's often filmed, but vampire lore does tell us that vampires cannot cross running water. In the story, as in this episode, Morton very much wants Hyacinth to cross over to him, or to cross over to her, which she absolutely forbids. But in doing so, she makes a promise. She says, and I quote, I am promising to meet you on the bank, and soon. For the water within these banks is moving slower, always slower. Higher up, I have heard that the canal has been drained. Between these lower locks, the water still seeps in and drops slowly, slowly downstream. But there will come a night when it will be quite, quite stagnant. And on that night, I will come to you. I will ask a favor. And you will keep your oath, end quote. I have something more to tell you about the original story, but the episode has swiftly brought us to this climactic scene, whereas in the story it is Morton who finds in Hyacinth a way of turning his own act of suicide into an act of humanity-loving heroism. In the episode, Hyacinth begs Ron to use this immense wooden thing to release her from her undeath. The dialogue makes the symbolism unmistakable.
I have to do this, you understand?
Darling. As you plunge it in, cry out that you love me.
How did they ever get that past the network censors? Getting back to the story, Morton later learns from his would-be friend at the office that the row of tumble-down houses along the canal which drew him to Hyacinth are connected with a terrible incident in the area's past. Quote, it was in all the papers. A little child disappeared in one of those houses, and a couple of poor lodgers who lived there, a girl and her father, were accused of having made away with it. The child's body was found. It was mutilated, and the people in the house seemed to believe it had been mutilated in order to conceal the manner of its death. There was an ugly wound in the throat. The old man and his daughter escaped before the police were called, but they were never found. End quote. If only the episode had another 25 minutes or so to play with, it could have reinforced its story with this and other macabre threads lovingly woven into its original telling. Over the years, Everell Worrell published 18 stories in the pages of Weird Tales. She retired at the end of 1957 and died on November 27, 1969. As for Leonard Nimoy, this episode really didn't do much for his career as a director, but unlike Hyacinth, he at least got his feet wet. Before his death in 2015, he directed a few blockbusters, including two Star Trek films, and he also left behind several volumes of poetry and autobiography. I'm Tim Lucas, and I thank you for watching with me.